It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, it's Food Friday. And we're taking a trip to Puerto Rico to learn more about the island's culture, history, and cooking. But first, Cyclone Freddy, which just dissipated after raging for 34 days, has broken multiple records. Cyclone Freddy's the longest-lasting tropical cyclone ever observed, the most energetic tropical cyclone on record, and there's more. So far, there have been over 300 deaths and tens of thousands of people displaced in Malawi and Mozambique, the countries most affected by this storm. And we're talking about climate change and extreme weather events in the wake of this record-breaking Cyclone Freddy. And we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the nexus of climate change and our extreme weather events? Do you worry about natural disasters like these and climate change? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. Joining us to start off our discussion is Derek Herndon. He's an assistant researcher at the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, where he studies hurricane intensity. Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Lee. Yeah, thank you for having me, and good job getting that out. That's a mouthful.
It is, but you've got a lot going on there. And so from your perspective, give us some idea of just how broad, big, and menacing this Cyclone Freddy was.
Well, as you mentioned on the intro there, it's really the thing we're going to remember this storm for is its longevity. You know, 34 days is a long time for a cyclone to exist. So typically, these storms only exist for 5, maybe 10 days. We occasionally see storms go for 2 weeks, but to go for more than 30 days really is pretty spectacular. So it's very unusual in that regard. It was also a fairly strong storm, so it reached a Category 5 intensity, what we would consider on the Saffir-Simpson scale in the Atlantic. So really at the top end of the scale in terms of intensity. It didn't make landfall at that intensity. It was a weaker storm. But the long storm track and the slow motion over land really are going to be the features we'll probably remember about this storm.
Yeah. What do you have to compare it to in terms of tropical storms? Although this is historic, have we seen anything else like this in terms of duration, strength, and for that matter, Derek, the number of times it intensified?
Right. So in terms of comparing it to a storm that lasted a similar amount of time, the last storm was Hurricane John in 1994. That storm formed in the eastern Pacific off the coast of Mexico, passed near Hawaii, and actually ended up almost to the Aleutian Islands. That storm actually started as a disturbance all the way back in Africa that we can track. But when we look at the tracks of these storms, we kind of start tracking them once they become what we call a tropical cyclone, so sustained winds of at least of about 30 miles per hour or stronger. So 1994 would be the closest analog, and this storm beat that storm by a couple of days.
And tell me a little bit about how this storm was, it set a record for the number of times it intensified, 7 times. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, that also is curious. Partly, I think, it's just the length of the storm, how long it lasted, gave it opportunities to change intensity a couple of times. The storm actually struggled a fair amount as it was tracking from the east towards the west in the southern Indian Ocean. It was battling some bouts of dry air that kind of pulled into the storm, and some upper-level winds were kind of trying to weaken it. So those factors weakened the storm a little bit, but every time it bounced back, and whenever it bounced back, it actually bounced back fairly fast. So that's where we get that rapid intensity. So we're talking a change of intensity of about 40 miles per hour in about 24 hours or so. And it did that 7 times. Very unusual, and we've not seen a storm do that. Again, partly because the storm spent so much time over very, very warm water.
Derek Herndon, our guest, assistant researcher at the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. And so what do we know about the conditions that kept this storm going for so long, the conditions that made it so intense, and the conditions that reinvigorated it so many times, Derek?
So the conditions that kept it so intense were really tied to the fact that the storm really wasn't gaining any latitude. It wasn't moving towards the polar regions like many storms do. There was actually a storm out ahead of the storm, Dingane, which did recurve into the poles and did not last very long. But in the wake of that storm, the subtropical ridge kind of built in and kind of trapped Freddy from gaining any latitude, and basically moved almost due east to due west. And the area that it moved over is very, very warm. So the water was plenty warm enough to support the intensity and these intensity changes. So the primary thing that kept it going really was those warm waters. And those waters are based on, you know, changes over many decades, 30 years, we can look at the averages are warmer than average.
Well, 30 years is where you take us back to about the last analogous tropical storm event when you mentioned Hurricane John in 1994. Is this something we'd expect in another 30 years, or might we see something like Cyclone Freddy sooner than that again, do you suspect?
I highly doubt we'll see anything like it soon, because the conditions that produced this long track really just all kind of cut. Basically, all the things had to come together at exactly the right time. And to have that happen is it's fairly rare, as we've seen. But there is some indication that storms might be slowing down. And that's because the Arctic is warming at a faster rate than the rest of the planet is. What that does is it changes the temperature gradient from north to south and makes it weaker. Well, the weaker temperature gradient also means that the wind flow, the jet stream, is also weaker. So that's what's pushing these storms. And with weaker wind flow, these storms will spend more time over water and in some cases spend more time over land. That was really the problem with this storm, is that once it did move into Madagascar, it stalled. And we're starting to see that that is becoming more common, that these storms are moving slower. And because they're moving slower, they're producing more rainfall.
So what do your fellow researchers, how do you look and talk about Cyclone Freddy? How do you put this in some context of the work that you do every day, Derek?
The work that we do every day really is about trying to understand these intensity changes, trying to observe them from satellites, because keep in mind that as Freddy's moving across the Indian Ocean, there are no observations there. There are very few islands, and all the ships are getting out of the way, and there aren't really many buoys there either. So the only way that we can observe these storms is from satellite data. So that's what I do on the day-to-day. I am analyzing satellite data to estimate how strong the storm is, the storm's position, which way it's moving, and also the environment that the storm exists in. So we're using this satellite data to analyze, is there any dry air in the environment, and what is the steering flow look like for this storm? And I should note, you know, that some of our satellites are starting to age, so we're trying to replace those. And we have some new satellite launches going up later this year to help with that.
When I follow the track of Cyclone Freddy, it seemed to bounce for a while between the island of Madagascar and the southeastern coast of Africa. What was going on there? Was it going back and forth like that?
It really was going back and forth like that. It crossed Madagascar and moved, Madagascar, moved into Mozambique. It stalled. And then the wind flow basically changed and pushed it back out over the channel, where it found warmer water again, re-intensified, approached Madagascar again, stalled, and then turned again and moved back towards Mozambique. So what's happening there is that the flow is transient and changing, and is also fairly weak. And that's really what promotes these slow stalling storms.
The way you speak of it, it makes me think of a living thing. Like this storm is actually feeding, and it is, you know, expending energy. It is stalling out, resting, but then it's getting back on its feet again and recharging and going back out there.
Sure. As long as the storm is over water, there's potential for it to intensify. Once the storm moves over land, it loses its heat source and will eventually spin down. Unfortunately, in this case, it did so very slowly and did not move very much.
But with the jet stream slowing, being weaker, and you mentioned the storm slowing down, is this something we might see again sooner rather than later?
Absolutely. There was another storm back in 2019, Cyclone Idai, that did a very similar track to what Freddy did, at least in that area around Mozambique and Madagascar. And that storm was devastating, over 1,500 deaths. Again, most of those deaths are from flooding, freshwater flooding.
Hey, Derek, I appreciate you starting this conversation with us this afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Derek Herndon, assistant researcher at the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Studies, Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, joining us today to look at climate change, extreme weather events, and the record-breaking Cyclone Freddy that killed hundreds. We invite you to join the conversation because we're going to continue now with a more global look at not just the cyclone itself, but the global climate. And you can join us with your questions or comments about what you see, what you fear at 800-642-1234, or your hopes for what we may learn about our global climate change and our role in it. 800-642-1234, or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up the conversation about Cyclone Freddy, which has devastated Malawi and Mozambique, two countries in southeastern Africa that already struggle with high poverty rates and food insecurity. Research has shown that poor countries are impacted disproportionately by climate change. Although they contribute the least to greenhouse gas emissions, poor countries are more vulnerable to the effects of climate change, including more extreme weather events like Cyclone Freddy. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're taking a look at how climate change affects impoverished populations now. And our guest, next guest is Laurie DePreet Brown, Director for Global Health and Human Ecology and Distinguished Teaching Faculty in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She's also a co-director, along with Zikani Kwanda, on the Malawi Circle of Care Project. And Laurie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And we also have Dr. Zikani Kwanda joining us. He's the director of the Institute for Participatory Engagement and Quality Improvement, a Malawian non-governmental organization that works with UW-Madison. Dr. Zikani, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Hey, doctor, where are you this afternoon?
Right in Zomba, southern part of Malawi, near where we are experiencing the cyclone devastation impact currently. That's where we are.
And tell me, yes, please tell me what you see, Dr. Kwanda.
Well, I think what we're seeing here is that something which has happened, which has never happened. Some people from the historical perspective, they say they've never seen such a devastating thing for more than 40 years. It's quite new, and it has affected most parts of the rural areas. And then we also have got some challenges with the same impact in the city, Blantyre, which usually has never faced such calamities. Usually it has been in the rural areas.
Go ahead.
Yes. Currently we're seeing a lot of people around trying to support wherever they can. And we are also, you know, trying to find out how many people actually have been affected by this cyclone. So what has happened is that what we're seeing is that, first of all, the attention was paid towards the city, because that's where, you know, many people are. And it was something very strange to see such thing happening. But more especially it happened because we had flash floods coming from the mountains. Hmm. People are saying that this is because the mountain, which previously was preserved for catchment, being a catchment area for water source. But somehow, as the population has been growing, most of those trees were cut down, and people started building in those mountains. What we can see and what we remember is that the other people, the city people, tried to get an injunction that people should not build in those areas, but they continued building in those areas. 5 years ago, this was said that this is not an area to reside or to construct things. But now, 5 years down the road, we have this calamity where more than 352 people have died. And plus in the rural areas, we're having the numbers are quite high. I think we are yet to get numbers from the rural setting. What we can see also is that the first attention was given to the cities, as I said, but right now it's when it's going, the rescue operations are going out into the rural areas. These are very poor people. If you had a chance, you'd see that in the rivers, the people, some of them are stuck. They're just there. For 3 days, they could not, be rescued. We didn't have any helicopters. We didn't have any speedboats that could go and take these people. And they just, were in their trees. Some of them, because of being tired and hungry, they could fall into the water and off and we have lost such people. So it's a very disastrous. And then they are using some canoes, which they have some, but it's nothing really if you compare to the rescue operations that are support that happen in other countries. It's going to be very tough for these people to come back to their lives, in the sense that most of the houses where these floods have happened, they are submerged, some have collapsed, and the crops, which were about to be, you know, quite ready for eating and harvesting, it's all gone, and it's they have literally nothing right now. So to cope up with such things, what we're seeing is that the religious people are coming in, trying to comfort them. Some of them are putting together some resources to help them. They have also put some camps where they are sitting and where they're staying. But really, it's very hard. And, you know, some of the things which we're seeing here is quite devastating. You see just maybe a child of about 9 years old, the father, the mother, the brothers all gone and just alone. I don't know. It's just traumatic.
I am so very sorry to hear it, but I want to thank you for sharing what's happening in Malawi. That's Dr. Zikani Kaunda, who is the director of the Institute for Participatory Engagement and Quality Improvement, which is a Malawian non-government organization that works with the UW-Madison, with what's happening in the aftermath of Cyclone Freddy. Also joining us, Lori DePreet Brown, Director for Global Health and Human Ecology and a distinguished teaching faculty in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Lori, let me turn to you for a second, just to get some reaction on what Zikani Kaunda is seeing in Malawi today and how he describes the flash flooding that came from the mountains after the clear cutting of trees, what comes after when the crops have all been washed away in a subsistence farming area. How do you describe what is happening in the aftermath of Cyclone Freddy?
Well, I think, you know, when we think about, you know, what this is, it's really a complex emergency. And this happens to be a cyclone. We can think about earthquakes. We can think about disease outbreaks. And whenever those things happen, besides analyzing causes and understanding causes, which is very important for prevention, I think it's a moment of response. And what we see again and again in these situations is food systems, energy systems, all communications broken down, housing, which is very, you know, the most vulnerable folks are people whose you know, roofs are already were incomplete. And so the housing structures come into it, and then people's livelihoods of all kinds are disrupted. The other thing is the kind of PTSD or the emotional trauma, if you will, not just of the community, but of the workforce that has to continually respond. And, you know, in our situation, sometimes those folks are people who've experienced some of the other complex emergencies in Malawi. And it really is this kind of this again moment, even though we're describing it as very rare, having to respond to crisis that is systemic and that it's so long term. The long shadow of this is so much more than what the news cycle will be. And we struggle. Dr. Zikani has mentioned the struggle with, you know, differential responses to the city and the rural area can be more isolated. They don't even know what's going on. I think the other thing we can look at is the global responses and how we might respond differently and maybe, you know, maybe less, to be honest, when it is an African where people seem very different from us, because these folks are extremely resilient. You know, think of your grandfather on the farm, you know, fighting to get all the pigs inside during a storm or whatever. That's the kind of grit that people are talking about. And they are relying on their faith and each other and those kind of community systems to get through. But I hope we'll keep paying attention for the long haul to really have true and meaningful development, as well as all the prevention that needs to happen.
So this has disrupted all aspects of life, and I can't even fathom that, you know, your food sources are gone, your communication's down, your housing is gone, your livelihoods are disrupted. And Lori, just to reiterate here, you said maybe while we should pay attention to it, that we should step back from it a little bit?
No, I'm saying we should keep paying attention.
Yes.
Way of, the crisis moment is only one part of a complex emergency. The cholera, you know, the risks, the housing, the issue of livelihoods and what people have to resort to earn a living when other livelihoods are you know, this is a 2 or 3 year engagement with communities, not just today. Yes. And it's just so hard, you know, to extend the news cycle. But yeah, keep paying attention to these, to the holistic impacts.
And let us turn our attention back to Dr. Zakani here, who is in Malawi for us this afternoon. Freddie is just one disaster, doctor, but there are long-term effects. What kind of long-term support do Malawi and other countries need when it comes to recovering from the disaster that they're facing right now?
Yeah, so I think what we're looking here, the challenge is that right now we're looking at the immediate, you know, support that they should be given, that's that they should come back to their lives. But I think the long term, we you know, when you look at the long term, it's how will these establish themselves in the society? So they're of different ages, as I've mentioned. So you talk about the young ones who have lost their parents. All along they were depending upon those parents. So in such a case, it needs long term support in terms of whether it's financial, for them to attend their education or for them to find their livelihood. And those could be long term for those type of people. But when you talk about the elderly ones, so probably what we're looking at, like in these other areas where we are right now, is that, you know, so all the crops are gone, mm-hmm. and the land is also maybe just having some rocks everywhere, because it you know, you cannot maybe grow such crops. So you've got to start thinking of whether they should be relocated or to a place where they can. If they were, like in the rural areas, these were farmers.
Yes.
They cannot completely change to something else.
Doctor, I apologize. We are out of time, and we've got news right ahead. That's Dr. Zakani Kaunda, director of the Institute for Participatory Engagement and Quality Improvement, joining us live from Malawi today, along with Laurie Dupreet-Brown, director for Global Health and Human Ecology and a distinguished teaching faculty in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, get ready to laugh. Our guest will talk about the mental and physical benefits of laughing and how even a forced laugh can boost your mood. But for now, it's Food Friday. And today we're going to get to know one of the great Latin American food cultures that often gets overlooked here in the U.S. Puerto Rico has a rich culinary tradition that was disrupted by colonization but remains strong in those who take the time to continue it. And our next guest is at the forefront of those efforts. She's here to bring her family's Puerto Rican cooking to our kitchen. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Puerto Rican cuisine? Have you had much Puerto Rican food in your life? And what are some of your favorites? What would you like to try? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page as well. Ileana Maisonet is the first Puerto Rican food columnist in the U.S., and her new cookbook is called Diasporican, a Puerto Rican cookbook. Ileana, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And let's just start with how you got started in the kitchen and a little bit of your history, if you would. What made you so, what got you cooking authentic Puerto Rican foods?
Well, first of all, I think I would be careful when we use the terminology authentic, because authentic to me is not necessarily authentic to other Puerto Ricans, because everybody does things differently. I think that I started to really dive into my grandma's recipes when I finished culinary school in 2009, so...
Yeah, and that's part of your book, Diasporican, is the diversity within the Puerto Rican community and how that's reflected in your food and also in your cookbook. It's not just a cookbook. It's also a memoir. It's a story of you, but it's also the story of Puerto Rico itself. How did it all come together for you?
Well, you know, I just feel like it's almost impossible to talk about Puerto Rican food or really kind of any food in general without talking about the history of things, because the history is what created kind of the unique diversity that is Puerto Rican food, you know, like, and I feel like that's why a lot of people don't really know anything about it, because, you know, people like things to be in a nice little tight unique box because it's easy to understand, but that's not Puerto Rican food.
So if that's not what Puerto Rican food is, Ileana, tell us, how would you describe it?
Well, for me, which is the reason why my book is called Diaspora Rican, is, you know, I'm cooking Puerto Rican food out of Northern California, which is where I was born and raised, you know. So the way that my grandmother did it kind of changed, you know, from being in California and having to work with what she had. So if we're going to make things like pasteles, which is a really traditional and old Puerto Rican recipe, that's pretty much like, you know, indigenous, usually it's wrapped with banana or plantain leaves, and now they do plantain leaves and parchment paper, but she did neither. She wrapped it in foil because aluminum foil was a lot easier and more economic. And that's how I make pasteles. But, you know, if I'm talking to somebody in Puerto Rico on the island and I say that, it's an abomination.
So it really does run the gamut. Ileana Mazanet, our guest for this Food Friday, talking about Puerto Rican cuisine and asking you what you've tried and what you've enjoyed and what you're curious about trying. Let's take your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Scott in West Bend standing by. Scott, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What do you like? What do you know?
Okay, so last January we went on a trip to Puerto Rico, and I got to try a lot of the different foods there, but I have to say my favorite is mofongo. It's mashed plantain. It's kind of similar to mashed potatoes, but it's even better, and a lot of times they'll serve it with a protein, like we would eat it with chicken a lot. So good. I just love mofongo.
Mofongo. Ileana, tell us about it.
So mofongo is a dish that's pretty, I would say it's one of the older recipes. It's made out of, there are different types, mofongo, bifongo, bifongo, and trifongo. Mofongo is just mashed, fried green plantains. And then if you add like another tuber to it, like yuca or ripe plantains, then it becomes a bifongo, b being bi, meaning two. Mm-hmm. And if you add like the green, the yellow, and like yuca, then it becomes the trifongo. And now you have like three of them. It's mashed and it's usually stuffed or topped with like shrimp criolla, which is like a red sauce garlicky shrimp, or sometimes fried chicken, sometimes fried pork.
It sounds delicious. That now you mentioned the garlic. What are some of the flavors that that your pantry has, Ileana, that if we wanted to try some Puerto Rican foods, we'd want to make staples of our pantry?
The things that I always keep on hand, and I feel like almost every Puerto Rican will always keep on hand to make Puerto Rican food, is garlic, obviously, tomatoes, canned tomato sauce, or if you're in the UK or Australia, then you're going to use passata because you don't have access to tomato sauce, and sofrito. Sofrito is just like the base herb blend to all of our savory cooking. It has cilantro or culantro, garlic, onions, peppers, and tomatoes, which is a kind of a controversial ingredient.
I'm sorry, why is it controversial?
Because not everyone uses tomatoes in it. A lot of people don't think that tomatoes belong in it, but there is a difference between sofrito and recaito. Recao is the word that we use for culantro, which is what we used before we found cilantro. You know, they're two different things, of course. And I just personally find that adding tomatoes, once it cooks down, it's almost the same way that if you would add, the reason why you're adding tomato sauce, like it kind of just adds a nice, like a sweetness and a juiciness to it.
It sounds like no matter what recipe you bring up, there would be some debate around whether or not this is the way to do it. These are the ingredients for
exactly.
It.
Exactly. Everyone has their own way of doing it. And the thing is that every Puerto Rican says that is the way that it should be done. Well, mostly you should be saying, this is how my family does it, and this is how I like it, instead of saying, this is how it is, punta. Punto. Period.
I think I would enjoy some of those debates and then being the taste tester to be able to try them out. I just wouldn't want to be the judge and have to say one is better than the other at any point. So tell me some of the feedback. I mean, just to remind folks, your book was named one of the best cookbooks of 2022 by the New York Times. But I am curious, considering what we've just talked about, what some of the feedback might have been so far from others who were like, that's not how we do it here.
Well, I think the reason why I think that I have already gotten all of the negative feedback early on in my career when I wrote as a columnist for The Chronicle. I already got a lot of those emails back then. So I think a lot of those, I've kind of weeded out a lot of those purists, the traditionalists. But I also think that I got away with a lot because I called the book Diasporic, because it's coming from a perspective of the Puerto Ricans here that are living stateside, as opposed to the Puerto Ricans that are living on the island. So I'm not necessarily talking to the Ricans de la Isla. I'm talking to all the ones here, and all the ones here, their experiences are very similar to mine. So they totally understand.
Well, and that too seems to be reflected quite well in your book, Ileana, because it seems as though, as I go through these recipes, there are just not a lot there that I wouldn't be able to pick up at a local grocery store and take home and make my own.
Right, exactly.
What would be an easy one for me to try? Something that, you know, would be a basic level, 100 level course of Puerto Rican cuisine.
I always tell people to start with the carne guisada, but I tell them to start with pollo guisado, which is made with chicken. If you're going to make it with like beef, then it's called a carne guisada. If you make it with chicken, it's called pollo guisado. I always tell people to start there because chicken is so readily available and because it's so affordable and everything that goes into it, you can find at any grocery store across the country.
Pollo guisado, take us through it a little bit.
So all you do is, if you want to, you can fortify what's in the sofrito by first sauteing like onions and garlic, which I usually do. Mm-hmm. And then I will sear off some chicken thighs. Sometimes if I'm in a rush, boneless, skinless chicken thighs, because the prep's already done for you. And then I add a little bit of tomato sauce, a little bit of water, some olives, some olive brine. And then I'll let that braise for like 40 minutes or until the chicken is tender. And then right towards the end, that is when I will add my sofrito, because I feel like it kind of serves a more kind of vibrancy, more kind of like a herbal punch, you know. You can taste all of the herbs that are in the sofrito. And then I usually make it and serve it over white rice.
It sounds delicious, and it's all part of her new cookbook, Diasporican, a Puerto Rican cookbook, from our guest, Ileana Maisonet, food columnist and author, and we're talking about Puerto Rican cuisine, and we invite you to join our conversation. Do you have any connections to Puerto Rican culture? And if you've been to Puerto Rico, what did you try that you'd like to try again now that you're back home? Tell us your experiences. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. This week's Food Friday continues, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Ileana Maisonet. She was the first Puerto Rican food columnist in the U.S. Her new book is called Diasporican, a Puerto Rican cookbook. And we want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. What would you like to try? Is Puerto Rican cooking a part of your family tradition? And what experiences have you had with Puerto Rican food? Join us. And if you have any questions, we've got the expert here, but evidently, you know, it can run the gamut. So it's all to taste, and from family passed down from generation to generation, as our guest details with us this afternoon. The number again, 800-642-1234. We covered pollo guisado here, Ileana, and I wrote down olive brine because that's something, why have I not put that in my food before? That sounds like a wonderful way to add a little bit of punch to just about anything. But when I'm looking for other recipes, some can, as you write in your book, some can take years to come up with, like Mallorcas. Can you explain a little bit of these and why developing this recipe took so long for you?
Oh, because I'm not a baker. I'm born a baker.
Well, that's easy.
It's really that simple. I'm just a horrible, horrible baker. You know, I think that at the time, there weren't a lot of recipes available for Mallorcas, because the two places that are really well known for Mallorcas in Puerto Rico are obviously very protective of the recipes. Mm-hmm. They're also both very old. One of them is like 100 years old. It's still open in Old San Juan. And so the recipes that were available, I started to think that a lot of people were not testing the recipes that they were writing. So the first couple of times that I tried it, they were, you know, really bready and very dry. And they were not reminiscent of the Mallorcas that I had. So I knew that that wasn't the recipes that I needed to, that I was going to settle on. So that's why I was trying to mimic the ones that I knew.
And you've got that in your book.
I think so.
And would, I'm not a baker either, but it doesn't seem like it's so complicated that I couldn't give it a try and see if I can come up with something.
No, you can. I mean, it's still going to be a pain, in my opinion, but it might be worth it. It depends.
Let's go back to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Celia in Madison joins us. Good afternoon, Celia.
Good afternoon. I am a huge fan of Puerto Rico. I've been there twice, to Bogarón and Vieques and the Ponce de Leon restaurant in New York. And I always eat Goya beans, especially the black ones. But my question is, at the restaurant in New York years ago, I had Spanish green sauce, which is different from the Italian. And I did find a recipe for it, but now I've lost it. What are the greens in Spanish green sauce, specifically made by Puerto Ricans?
Great question. Ileana?
I'm assuming she's talking about sofrito, because in, you know, Italy and Italians, they have their own sofrito and we have our sofrito. But the green version is what I was talking about earlier, which is the recaito.
And that would, I remember the garlic.
Right, so it has the cilantro, the recao, the garlic, the onions, and the peppers.
So does sofrito sound about right to you, Celia?
Even about this, it was a sauce, and you couldn't distinguish the leaves of anything. That's what made it different.
Huh. Interesting. Any idea, Liana?
Nope.
Interesting. But so you mentioned, and Celia, I appreciate the call, because you mentioned the Spanish green sauce and the Italian green sauce, and it comes with this complexity of cultures that is reflected in the food. And how does this complexity of Puerto Rican culture reflect itself in the food as you see it and you cook it, Ileana?
Well, it's just like what I said earlier. Just because you have a sauce at a Puerto Rican restaurant doesn't mean that it's a Puerto Rican sauce. It can be particular to that particular restaurant.
Sure, sure. And, you know, your book also lays out some of the traditions and methods that are central to Puerto Rican cooking. What are some of the most important practices that you follow in your work?
You know, I just try to follow my grandma's recipes, because that's what's true to me. That's my own experience, you know. And I just, being from Northern California, I just try to use the freshest ingredients possible, because that's how I like to cook, and that's, I like to support my local farmers, and I like to go out to the farmers market and stuff like that. So those two things are just things that I usually abide by.
And when we talk about, you know, the Spanish green sauce, the Italian green sauce, part of this is not directly mentioned, but let's bring it up, the colonization and how, what kind of impact that has on Puerto Rican culture and food.
Right. Well, I'm not sure what Italian green sauce has anything to do with Puerto Rican sauce. Okay. At all. I'm totally baffled by that. I don't know. You know, like, as far as colonization goes, what we have, as you can clearly see, is like a huge Spanish influence, African influence, and then our indigenous influence, which is what most Puerto Ricans like to say that they are made up out of: Taino Indians, Africans, and the Spaniards.
There's another recipe that looks easy to me. Ileana Maisonet, our guest for this week's Food Friday, food columnist and author of the cookbook Diasporican, a Puerto Rican cookbook. Forgive me if I mispronounce this, Ileana. Funche? Is that how you pronounce it?
Funche.
Funche. Yeah, yes. This looks like I could do this. Tell us about it.
Well, funche is just like what a lot of people would call porridge. It's made out of cornmeal. Mm-hmm. And you can add you know, water if you don't have access or money for milk, or you can use milk. Most of the time it's made with coconut milk, and it can be eaten for breakfast with like cinnamon and brown sugar, but it could also be eaten as a base for, like, I use it for my shrimp and grits, but it's also used with, like a bacalao stew.
Shrimp and grits. That speaks to me. Let's continue with your calls now at 1-800-642-1234 for our guest, Ileana Maisonette. Lorraine Beaver Dam, good afternoon.
Hello. I just wanted to comment or have your speaker comment on lechon, I believe it's called. I've been to Puerto Rico twice, and we love searching for the, I think it's like a rotisserie pig. They do the whole pig, and it seems like it's only on Sundays, but it's delicious.
Sunday rotisserie pig in Puerto Rico, Ileana?
Well, so lechon is spit, our traditional pig. It's spit roasted over an open fire. There is an area in Puerto Rico called Guavate El Calle, which is like, it's like just, they have a long, it's called the Ruta de Lechon. So it's just a entire road of various different lechons that you can go and visit. And everybody kind of like, you know, battles each other for like the best lechon. It's in the mountains. And I don't think that that's just on Sundays. I feel like some of them are also open during the week. Well, I know some of them are also open on the weekdays. Most of them are open on Mondays, or I mean, Saturdays and Sundays. And we typically roast pigs for like special occasions and the holidays, just because it takes a lot of time.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Let's go now to Melissa in Mequon, who joins us. Melissa, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good, thank you. What do you have for us?
Well, I am just desperate to find some authentic culantro seeds. And I'm just wondering if there's a recommendation of an online place or, you know, somewhere to source them.
Authentic cilantro seeds. Ileana?
No, culantro seeds.
Culantro seeds. My apologies. Yeah.
You know, I don't particularly know a source. I know they're available online, but you could try... Google is your best friend, as I tell everyone.
You can Google that. One of the other cooking aspects of Puerto Rican food is deep frying. And so how prominent is deep frying in Puerto Rican cooking, Ileana?
I personally don't think that it's that prominent. When we're talking about frituras, they are mostly like special occasion party holiday snacks. You know what I mean? The reason why I think that it just seems like maybe it's prominent because there are so many varieties, but that's because they're so easy and quick to make. And you really only get them in Puerto Rico when you're on the beach because it's a quick snack to have, and it's a perfect accompaniment to an icy cold beer.
Mm, yes. What with your book, Diaspora Rican, what are your hopes for it? And it came out last year, but, you know, what do you hope folks get from it when they open it up?
I think what I am always talking about, that there is no one way to make Puerto Rican food. Your way is not the way.
Even my way would not be obviously my way would not be the way, but wouldn't be the wrong way necessarily. It's so what makes, is it what tastes right for you? Is it what the family has passed down to you? How do you define it, you know, from your cookbook, what is Puerto Rican food?
It's all of that. It's how you remember it. It's how you enjoy it. You know, like there are always going to be similar components to all of our recipes with like little minute tweaks. So it still kind of exists in the way that it should.
And I've got to ask, what are you cooking next? What's in your kitchen and what are you getting ready for?
Well, it's Lent, so I am a cultural Catholic, so I will be cooking fish tonight.
give us some idea. How are you going to be cooking it up?
I'm just going to make my fish. I'm making some cod with just a lot of lemon, because that's how I like it. And I'll be using my adobo seasoning that I made with a company called Burlap and Barrel. It's a salt-free adobo. And we also have a sazon, and we're the only sazon on the market that uses wild achote directly from Puerto Rico.
So you're just taking your own spices and use them, and you make it very easy for the rest of us, Ileana.
It's super easy. All it is just cod, lemon, adobo, some butter. I'm literally going to put it in a foil packet and put it in an air fryer.
Ileana, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Ileana Maisonet, the first Puerto Rican food columnist in the U.S., with us today to share her new book, Diasporican, a Puerto Rican cookbook. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, two-thirds of the way through tax season, Kate Archer Kent checks in with the state revenue secretary about filings, the budget surplus, and the outlook for the budget writing season. That's coming up Monday morning here on the Ideas Network from 7 until 9. The Central Time got together on Tuesday for Pie Day, and our producer, Emily Burdett, brought a delicious key lime pie. Today is Emily's last day working with us, and you need to know she's been responsible for so much of what you've enjoyed on Central Time over this past year. I also want you to know that we begged and pleaded with her to stay, and she actually agreed to stick around as long as she could. She's got big plans to spend this spring and summer hiking thousands of miles across the country, and she's got to get going. In our send-off for her last night, we were joined by another former producer from Central Time, and what's obvious to all of us here is that Emily, like other producers who have moved on to bigger and better things, will always be a part of this Central Time team. So on behalf of Rob Ferret and all of us, past and present from Central Time, we thank Emily for her tireless work and her boundless heart. Remembering her Halloween costume of Frog from the classic Frog and Toad book series will always make me laugh. And by the way, Emily Burdett's last produced piece for Central Time's all about laughter. And that's coming up after the news here on Central Time.